of the war, but readiness for peace on a reasonable basis. But it was all unreal, all talk, and so confused were the plotters that Hassel devoted a long patch of his diary to the consideration of whether they should retain Goering or not. Goering himself, along with Hitler, Himmler, Goebbels, Ley, and other party leaders, used the new year to issue grandiose proclamations. Ley said, "The Führer is always right. Obey the Führer." The Führer himself proclaimed that not he, but the Jewish and capitalistic warmongers had started the war, and went on, "United within the country, economically prepared and militarily armed to the highest degree, we enter this most decisive year in German history. May the year 1940 bring the decision. It will be, whatever happens, our victory." On December 27th, he had again postponed the attack in the West by at least a fortnight. On January 10th, he ordered it definitely set for January 17th, 15 minutes before sunrise, 8:16 a.m. The Air Force was to begin its attack on January 14th, 3 days in advance, its task being to destroy enemy airfields in France, but not in Belgium and Holland. The two little neutral countries were to be kept guessing about their fate until the last moment. But on January 13th, the Nazi warlord suddenly postponed the onslaught again on account of the meteorological situation. The captured OKW file on D-Day in the West is thereafter silent until May 7th. Weather may have played a part in the calling off of the attack on January 13th, but we now know that two other events were mainly responsible: an unfortunate forced landing of a very special German military plane in Belgium on January 10th, and a new opportunity that now appeared to the North. On the very day, January 10th, that Hitler had ordered the attack through Belgium and Holland to begin on the 17th, a German military plane flying from Münster to Cologne became lost in the clouds over Belgium and was forced to land near Mechelen-sur-Meuse. In it was Major Helmut Rheinberger, an important Luftwaffe staff officer, and in his briefcase were the German plans, complete with maps, for the attack in the West. As Belgian soldiers closed in, the major made for some nearby bushes and lit a fire to the contents of his briefcase. Attracted by this interesting phenomenon, the Belgian soldiers stamped out the flames and retrieved what was left. Taken to military quarters nearby, Rheinberger, in a desperate gesture, grabbed the partly burned papers, which a Belgian officer had placed on a table, and threw them into a lighted stove. The Belgian officer quickly snatched them out. Rheinberger promptly reported to Luftwaffe headquarters in Berlin through his embassy in Brussels that he had succeeded in burning down the papers to insignificant fragments, the size of the palm of his hand. But in Berlin there was consternation in high quarters. Jodl immediately reported to Hitler on what the enemy may or may not know, but he did not know himself. "If enemy is in possession of all the files," he confided to his diary on January 12th after seeing the Führer, "the situation is catastrophic." That evening, Ribbentrop sent a most urgent wire to the German embassy in Brussels asking for an immediate report on the destruction of the courier baggage. On the morning of January 13th, Jodl's diary reveals, there was a conference of Goering with his air attaché in Brussels, who had flown post-haste back to Berlin, and the top Luftwaffe brass. Result? Dispatch case burned for certain, Jodl recorded. But this was whistling in the dark, as Jodl's journal makes clear. At 1 p.m. it noted, "Order to General Halder by telephone. All movements to stop." The same day, the 13th, the German ambassador in Brussels was urgently informing Berlin of considerable Belgian troop movements as a result of alarming reports received by the Belgian general staff. The next day, the ambassador got off another most urgent message to Berlin. The Belgians were ordering Phase D, the next-to-last step in mobilization, and calling up two new classes. The reason, he thought, was reports of German troop movements on the Belgian and Dutch frontiers, as well as the content of the partly unburned courier mail found on the German Air Force officer. By the evening of January 15th, doubts had risen in the minds of the top brass in Berlin whether Major Rheinberger had really destroyed the incriminating documents as he had claimed. "They were presumably burned," Jodl remarked after another conference on the matter. But on January 17th, the Belgian Foreign Minister, Paul-Henri Spaak, sent for the German ambassador and told him flatly, as the latter promptly reported to Berlin, that the plane which made an emergency landing on January 10th had put into Belgian hands a document of the most extraordinary and serious nature, which contained clear proof of an intention to attack. It was not just an operations plan, but an attack order worked out in every detail, in which only the time remained to be inserted. The Germans were never quite sure whether Spaak was not bluffing. On the Allied side, the British and French general staffs were given copies of the German plan. There was a tendency to view the German papers as a plant. Churchill says he vigorously opposed this interpretation and laments that nothing was done about this grave warning. What is certain is that on January 13th, the day after Hitler was informed of the affair, he postponed the attack, and that by the time it again came up for decision in the spring, the whole strategic plan had been fundamentally changed. But the forced landing in Belgium and the bad weather were not the only reasons for putting off the attack. Plans for a daring German assault on two other little neutral states farther to the north had in the meantime been ripening in Berlin and now took priority. The phony war, so far as the Germans were concerned, was coming to an end with the approach of spring. Chapter 20. The Conquest of Denmark and Norway. The innocent-sounding code name for the latest plan of German aggression was Weserübung, or Weser Exercise. Its origins and development were unique, quite unlike those for unprovoked attack that have filled so large a part of this narrative. It was not the brainchild of Hitler, as were all the others, but of an ambitious admiral and a muddled Nazi party hack. It was the only act of German military aggression in which the German Navy played the decisive role. It was also the only one for which OKW did the planning and coordinating of the three armed services. In fact, the Army High Command and its general staff were not even consulted, much to their annoyance, and Goering was not brought into the picture until the last moment, a slight that infuriated the corpulent chief of the Luftwaffe. The German Navy had long had its eyes on the north. Germany had no direct access to the wide ocean, a geographical fact which had been imprinted on the minds of its naval officers during the First World War. A tight British net across the narrow North Sea, from the Shetland Islands to the coast of Norway, maintained by a mine barrage and a patrol of ships, had bottled up the powerful Imperial Navy, seriously hampered the attempts of U-boats to break out into the North Atlantic, and kept German merchant shipping off the seas. The German High Seas Fleet never reached the high seas. The British naval blockade stifled Imperial Germany in the First War. Between the wars, the handful of German naval officers who commanded the country's modestly sized navy pondered this experience and this geographical fact, and came to the conclusion that in any future war with Britain, Germany must try to gain bases in Norway, which would break the British blockade line across the North Sea, open up the broad ocean to German surface and undersea vessels, and indeed offer an opportunity for the Reich to reverse the tables and mount an effective blockade of the British Isles. It was not surprising, then, that at the outbreak of war in 1939, Admiral Rolf Karls, the third-ranking officer in the German Navy and a forceful personality, should start peppering Admiral Raeder, as the latter noted in his diary and testified at Nuremberg, with letters suggesting the importance of an occupation of the Norwegian coast by Germany. Raeder needed little urging, and on October 3rd, at the end of the Polish campaign, sent a confidential questionnaire to the Naval War Staff, asking it to ascertain the possibility of gaining bases in Norway under the combined pressure of Russia and Germany. Ribbentrop was consulted about Moscow's attitude and replied that far-reaching support may be expected from that source. Raeder told his staff that Hitler must be informed as soon as possible about the possibilities. On October 10th, in the course of a lengthy report to the Führer on naval operations, Raeder suggested the importance of obtaining naval bases in Norway, if necessary, with the help of Russia. This, so far as the confidential records show, was the first time the Navy had directly called the matter to the attention of Hitler. Raeder says the leader saw at once the significance of the Norwegian problem. He asked him to leave his notes on the subject and promised to give the question some thought. But at the moment the Nazi warlord was preoccupied with launching his attack in the West and with overcoming the hesitations of his generals. It was on October 10th that Hitler had called in his military chiefs, read them a long memorandum on the necessity of an immediate attack in the West, and handed them Directive Number 6, ordering preparations for an offensive through Belgium and Holland. Norway apparently slipped out of his mind. But it came back in 2 months, for three reasons. One was the advent of winter. Germany's very existence depended upon the import of iron ore from Sweden. For the first war year, the Germans were counting on 11 million tons of it out of a total annual consumption of 15 million tons. During the warm weather months, this ore was transported from northern Sweden down the Gulf of Bothnia and across the Baltic to Germany, and presented no problem even in wartime, since the Baltic was effectively barred to British submarines and surface ships. But in the winter time, this shipping lane could not be used because of thick ice. During the cold months, the Swedish ore had to be shipped by rail to the nearby Norwegian port of Narvik, and brought down the Norwegian coast by ship to Germany. For almost the entire journey, German ore vessels could sail within Norway's territorial waters and thereby escape destruction by British naval vessels and bombers. Thus, as Hitler at first pointed out to the Navy, a neutral Norway had its advantages. It enabled Germany to obtain its lifeblood of iron ore without interference from Britain. In London, Churchill, then First Lord of the Admiralty, perceived this at once, and in the very first weeks of the war attempted to persuade the Cabinet to allow him to lay mines in Norwegian territorial waters in order to stop the German iron traffic. But Chamberlain and Halifax were most reluctant to violate Norwegian neutrality, and the proposal was for the time being dropped. Russia's attack on Finland on November 30, 1939, radically changed the situation in Scandinavia, immensely increasing its strategic importance to both the Western Allies and Germany. France and Britain began to organize an expeditionary force in Scotland to be sent to the aid of the gallant Finns, who, defying all predictions, held out stubbornly against the onslaughts of the Red Army. But it could reach Finland only through Norway and Sweden, and the Germans at once saw that if Allied troops were granted, or took transit across the northern part of the two Scandinavian lands, enough of them would remain, on the excuse of maintaining communications, to completely cut off Germany's supply of Swedish iron ore. It was a correct assumption. It is now known that the Allied Supreme War Council, meeting in Paris on February 5, 1940, decided that in sending an expeditionary force to Finland, the Swedish iron fields should be occupied by troops landed at Narvik, which was but a short distance from the mines. See the author's The Challenge of Scandinavia, pages 115 to 116. Note. Churchill remarks that at the meeting it was decided, incidentally, to get control of the Yellowvara ore field. The Gathering Storm, page 560. Moreover, the Western Allies would outflank the Reich on the north. Admiral Raeder was not backward in reminding Hitler of these threats. The chief of the German Navy had now found in Norway itself a valuable ally for his designs in the person of Major Vidkun Abraham Lauritz Quisling, whose name would soon become a synonym in almost all languages for a traitor. The Emergence of Vidkun Quisling. Quisling had begun life honorably enough. Born in 1887 of peasant stock, he had graduated first in his class at the Norwegian Military Academy, and while still in his 20s had been sent to Petrograd as military attaché. For his services in looking after British interests after diplomatic relations were broken with the Bolshevik government, Great Britain awarded him the CBE. At this time, he was both pro-British and pro-Bolshevik. He remained in Soviet Russia for some time as assistant to Fridtjof Nansen, the great Norwegian explorer and humanitarian, in Russian relief work. So impressed had the young Norwegian army officer been by the success of the communists in Russia that when he returned to Oslo, he offered his services to the Labour Party, which at that time was a member of the Comintern. He proposed that he establish a Red Guard, but the Labour Party was suspicious of him and his project and turned him down. He then veered to the opposite extreme. After serving as Minister of Defense from 1931 to 1933, he founded in May of the latter year a fascist party called Nationalsamling, National Union, appropriating the ideology and tactics of the Nazis, who had just come to power in Germany. But Nazism did not thrive in the fertile democratic soil of Norway. Quisling was unable even to get himself elected to parliament. Defeated at the polls by his own people, he turned to Nazi Germany. There he established contact with Alfred Rosenberg, the befuddled official philosopher of the Nazi movement, among whose jobs was that of chief of the party's Office for Foreign Affairs. This Baltic dolt, one of Hitler's earliest mentors, thought he saw possibilities in the Norwegian officer, for one of Rosenberg's pet fantasies was the establishment of a great Nordic empire, from which the Jews and other impure races would be excluded, and which eventually would dominate the world under Nazi German leadership. From 1933 on, he kept in touch with Quisling and heaped on him his nonsensical philosophy and propaganda. In June 1939, as the war clouds gathered over Europe, Quisling took the occasion of his attendance at a convention of the Nordic Society at Lübeck to ask Rosenberg for something more than ideological support. According to the latter's confidential reports, which were produced at Nuremberg, Quisling warned Rosenberg of the danger of Britain's getting control of Norway in the event of war and of the advantages to Germany of occupying it. He asked for some substantial aid for his party and press. Rosenberg, a great composer of memoranda, dashed out three of them for Hitler, Göring, and Ribbentrop, but the three top men appear to have ignored them. No one in Germany took the official philosopher very seriously. Rosenberg himself was able to arrange at least for a fortnight's training course in Germany in August for 25 of Quisling's husky stormtroopers. During the first months of the war, Admiral Raeder, or so he testified at Nuremberg, had no contact with Rosenberg, whom he scarcely knew, and none with Quisling, of whom he had never heard. But immediately after the Russian attack on Finland, Raeder began to get reports from his naval attaché at Oslo, Captain Richard Schreiber, of imminent Allied landings in Norway. He mentioned these to Hitler on December 8th and advised him flatly, "It is important to occupy Norway." Shortly afterward, Rosenberg dashed off a memorandum, undated, to Admiral Raeder, regarding visit of Privy Councillor Quisling, Norway. The Norwegian conspirator had arrived in Berlin, and Rosenberg thought Raeder ought to be told who he was and what he was up to. Quisling, he said, had many sympathizers among key officers in the Norwegian army, and, as proof, had shown him a recent letter from Colonel Konrad Sundlo, the commanding officer at Narvik, characterizing Norway's prime minister as a blockhead and one of his chief ministers as an old soak, and declaring his willingness to risk his bones for the national uprising. Later, Colonel Sundlo did not risk his bones to defend his country against aggression. Actually, Rosenberg informed Raeder, Quisling had a plan for a coup. It must have fallen upon sympathetic ears in Berlin, for it was copied from the Anschluss. A number of Quisling's stormtroopers would be hurriedly trained in Germany by experienced and die-hard National Socialists who are practiced in such operations. The pupils, once back in Norway, would seize strategic points in Oslo. And at the same time, the German Navy, with contingents of the German Army, will have to put in an appearance at a prearranged bay outside Oslo in answer to a special summons from the new Norwegian government. It was the Anschluss tactic all over again, with Quisling playing the part of Seyss-Inquart. "Quisling has no doubt," Rosenberg added, "that such a coup would meet with the approval of those sections of the army with which he now has connections. As regards the king, he believes that he would accept such a fait accompli." Quisling's estimate of the number of German troops needed for the operation coincides with the German estimates. Admiral Raeder saw Quisling on December 11th, the meeting being arranged through Rosenberg by one William Hagelin, a Norwegian businessman whose affairs kept him largely in Germany and who was Quisling's chief liaison there. Hagelin and Quisling told Raeder a mouthful, and he duly recorded it in the confidential naval archives. Quisling stated a British landing is planned in the vicinity of Stavanger, and Kristiansand is proposed as a possible British base. "The present Norwegian government, as well as the Parliament and the whole foreign policy, are controlled by the well-known Jew, Hambro, Karl Hambro, the president of the Storting. a great friend of Horobilisha. The dangers to Germany arising from a British occupation were depicted in great detail. To anticipate a British move, Quisling proposed to place the necessary bases at the disposal of the German armed forces. In the whole coastal area, men in important positions, railway, post office, communications, have already been bought for this purpose. He and Hagelin had come to Berlin to establish clear-cut relations with Germany for the future. Conferences are desired for discussion of combined action, transfer of troops to Oslo, etc. Raeder, as he later testified at Nuremberg, was impressed and told his two visitors that he would confer with the Führer and inform them of the results. This he did the next day at a meeting at which Keitel and Jodl were also present. The Navy Commander-in-Chief, whose report on this conference is among the captured documents, informed Hitler that Quisling had made a reliable impression on him. He then outlined the main points the Norwegians had made, emphasizing Quisling's good connections with officers in the Norwegian army, and his readiness to take over the government by a political coup and ask Germany for aid. All present agreed that a British occupation of Norway could not be countenanced, but Raeder, become suddenly cautious, pointed out that a German occupation would naturally occasion strong British countermeasures, and the German Navy is not yet prepared to cope with them for any length of time. In the event of occupation, this is a weak spot. On the other hand, Raeder suggested that OKW be permitted to make plans with Quisling for preparing and executing the occupation either A, by friendly methods, i.e. the German armed forces are called upon by Norway, or B, by force. Hitler was not quite ready to go so far at the moment. He replied that he first wanted to speak to Quisling personally in order to form an impression of him. This he did the very next day, December 14th, Raeder personally escorting the two Norwegian traitors to the Chancellery. Although no record of this meeting has been found, Quisling obviously impressed the German dictator, as he had the Navy chief, for that evening Hitler ordered OKW to work out a draft plan in consultation with Quisling. Halder heard that it would also include action against Denmark. Quisling had not impressed the German minister in Oslo, Dr. Kurt Breuer, who twice in December warned Berlin that Quisling need not be taken seriously. His influence and prospects are very slight. For his frankness and reluctance to play Hitler's game, the minister was quickly to pay. Hitler saw Quisling again on December 16th and 18th, despite his preoccupation with the bad news about the Graf Spee. The naval setback, however, seems to have added to his cautiousness about a Scandinavian adventure which would depend first of all on the Navy. According to Rosenberg, the Führer emphasized to his visitor that the most preferable attitude for Norway would be complete neutrality. However, if the British were preparing to enter Norway, the Germans would have to beat them to it. In the meantime, he would provide Quisling with funds to combat British propaganda and strengthen his own pro-German movement. An initial sum of 200,000 gold marks was allotted in January, with the promise of £10,000 sterling per month for 3 months beginning on March 15th. Shortly before Christmas, Rosenberg dispatched a special agent, Hans Wilhelm Scheidt, to Norway to work with Quisling. And over the holidays, the handful of officers at OKW who were in the know began working on Study North, as the plans were first called. In the Navy, opinion was divided. Raeder was convinced that Britain intended to move into Norway in the near future. The Operations Division of the Naval War Staff disagreed, and in its confidential war diary for January 13, 1940, their differences were aired. The Operations Division does not believe an imminent British occupation of Norway is probable. It considers, however, that an occupation of Norway by Germany, if no British action is to be feared, would be a dangerous undertaking. The Naval War Staff therefore concluded that the most favorable solution is definitely the maintenance of the status quo, and emphasized that this would permit the continued use of Norwegian territorial waters for the ore traffic in perfect safety. Hitler was displeased with both the hesitations of the Navy and the results of Study North, which OKW presented to him the middle of January. On January 27th, he had Keitel issue a top-secret directive stating that further work on North be continued under the Führer's personal and immediate supervision, and directing Keitel to take charge of all preparations. A small working staff composed of one representative from each of the three armed services was to be set up in OKW, and henceforth the operation was to have the code name Weserübung. This step seems to have marked the end of the Führer's hesitations about occupying Norway, but if there were any lingering doubts in his mind, they were dispelled by an incident which occurred in Norwegian waters on February 17th. An auxiliary supply ship of the Graf Spee, the Altmark, had managed to slip back through the British blockade, and on February 14th was discovered by a British scouting plane proceeding southward in Norwegian territorial waters toward Germany. The British government knew that aboard it were 300 captured British seamen from the ships sunk by the Graf Spee. They were being taken to Germany as prisoners of war. Norwegian naval officers had made a cursory inspection of the Altmark, found that it had no prisoners aboard and was unarmed, and given it clearance to proceed on to Germany. Now Churchill, who knew otherwise, personally ordered a British destroyer flotilla to go into Norwegian waters, board the German vessel, and liberate the prisoners. The British destroyer Cossack, commanded by Captain Philip Vian, carried out the mission on the night of February 16th to 17th in Jersingfjord, where the Altmark had sought safety. After a scuffle in which 4 Germans were killed and 5 wounded, the British boarding party liberated 299 seamen, who had been locked in storerooms and in an empty oil tank to avoid their detection by the Norwegians. The Norwegian government made a vehement protest to Britain about this violation of its territorial waters, but Chamberlain replied in the Commons that Norway itself had violated international law by allowing its waters to be used by the Germans to convey British prisoners to a German prison. For Hitler, this was the last straw. It convinced him that the Norwegians would not seriously oppose a British display of force in their own territorial waters. He was also furious, as Jodl noted in his diary, that the members of the Graf Spee crew aboard the Altmark had not put up a stiffer fight. No resistance, no British losses. On February 19th, Jodl's diary discloses, Hitler pressed energetically for the completion of plans for Weserübung. Equip ships, put units in readiness, he told Jodl. They still lacked an officer to lead the enterprise, and Jodl reminded Hitler that it was time to appoint a general and his staff for this purpose. Keitel suggested an officer who had fought with General von der Goltz's division in Finland at the end of the First World War, General Nikolaus von Falkenhorst, who now commanded an army corps in the West, and Hitler, who had overlooked the little matter of a commander for the Northern adventure, immediately sent for him. Though the general came from an old Silesian military family by the name of Jastrzemski, which he had changed to Falkenhorst, in German Falken's Eyrie, he was personally unknown to the Führer. Falkenhorst later described in an interrogation at Nuremberg their first meeting at the Chancellery on the morning of February 21st, which was not without its amusing aspects. Falkenhorst had never even heard of the North operation, and this was the first time he had faced the Nazi warlord, who apparently did not awe him as he had all the other generals. "I was made to sit down," he recounted at Nuremberg. "Then I had to tell the Führer about the operations in Finland in 1918. He said, 'Sit down and just tell me how it was,' and I did. Then we got up and he led me to a table that was covered with maps. He said, 'The Reich government has knowledge that the British intend to make a landing in Norway.' Falkenhorst said he got the impression from Hitler that it was the Altmark incident which had influenced the leader the most to carry out the plan now. And the general, to his surprise, found himself appointed then and there to do the carrying out as commander-in-chief. The army, Hitler added, would put 5 divisions at his disposal. The idea was to seize the main Norwegian ports. At noon, the warlord dismissed Falkenhorst and told him to report back at 5 p.m. with his plans for the occupation of Norway. "I went out and bought a Baedeker, a travel guide," Falkenhorst explained at Nuremberg, "in order to find out just what Norway was like. I didn't have any idea. Then I went to my hotel room and I worked on this Baedeker. At 5 p.m. I went back to the Führer." The general's plans worked out from an old Baedeker. He was never shown the plans worked out by OKW. Were, as can be imagined, somewhat sketchy, but they seem to have satisfied Hitler. One division was to be allotted to each of Norway's 5 principal harbors, Oslo, Stavanger, Bergen, Trondheim, and Narvik. "There wasn't much else you could do," Falkenhorst said later, "because they were the large harbors. After being sworn to secrecy and urged to hurry up, the general was again dismissed and thereupon set to work. Of all these goings-on, Brauchitsch and Halder, busy preparing the offensive on the Western Front, were largely ignorant until Falkenhorst called on the Army General Staff Chief on February 26th and demanded some troops, especially mountain units, to carry out his operation. Halder was not very cooperative. In fact, he was indignant and asked for more information on what was up and what was needed. "Not a single word on this matter has been exchanged between the Führer and Brauchitsch," Halder exclaimed in his diary. "That must be recorded for the history of the war." However, Hitler, full of contempt as he was for the old line generals and especially for his general staff chief, was not to be put off. On March 29th, he enthusiastically approved Falkenhorst's plans, including his acquisition of two mountain divisions, and moreover declared that more troops would be necessary because he wanted a strong force at Copenhagen. Denmark had definitely been added to the list of Hitler's victims. The Air Force had its eyes on bases there to be used against Britain. The next day, March 1st, Hitler issued the formal directive for Weser exercise. Most secret. Top secret. The development of the situation in Scandinavia requires the making of all preparations for the occupation of Denmark and Norway. This operation should prevent British encroachment on Scandinavia and the Baltic. Further, it should guarantee our ore base in Sweden and give our Navy and the Air Force a wider starting line against Britain. In view of our military and political power in comparison with that of the Scandinavian states, the force to be employed in Weser exercise will be kept as small as possible. The numerical weakness will be balanced by daring actions and surprise execution. On principle, we will do our utmost to make the operation appear as a peaceful occupation, the object of which is the military protection of the neutrality of the Scandinavian states. Corresponding demands will be transmitted to the governments at the beginning of the occupation. If necessary, demonstrations by the Navy and Air Force will provide the necessary emphasis. If, in spite of this, resistance should be met, all military means will be used to crush it. The crossing of the Danish border and the landings in Norway must take place simultaneously. It is most important that the Scandinavian states as well as the Western opponents should be taken by surprise. The troops may be acquainted with the actual objectives only after putting to sea. That very evening, March 1st, there was fury at the Army High Command, Jodl reported, because of Hitler's demands for troops for the northern operation. The next day, Göring raged at Keitel and went to complain to Hitler. The fat field marshal was furious at having been left out of the secret so long, and because the Luftwaffe had been put under Falkenhorst's command. Threatened by a serious jurisdictional dispute, Hitler convoked the heads of the three armed services to the Chancellery on March 5th to smooth matters out, but it was difficult. "Field Marshal Göring vents his spleen," Jodl wrote in his diary, "because he was not consulted beforehand. He dominates the discussion and tries to prove that all previous preparations are good for nothing." The Führer mollified him by some small concessions, and plans raced forward. As early as February 21st, according to his diary, Halder had got the impression that the attack on Denmark and Norway would not begin until after the offensive in the West had been launched and carried to a certain point. Hitler himself had been in doubt which operation to begin first and raised the question with Jodl on February 26th. Jodl's advice was to keep the two operations quite separate, and Hitler agreed, if it were possible. On March 3rd, he decided that Weser exercise would precede Case Yellow, the code name for attack in the West, and expressed very sharply to Jodl the necessity of prompt and strong action in Norway. By this time, the courageous but outmanned and outgunned Finnish army was facing disaster from a massive Russian offensive, and there were well-founded reports that the Anglo-French Expeditionary Corps was about to embark from its bases in Scotland for Norway and march across that country and Sweden to Finland to try to save the Finns. The threat of this was the main reason for Hitler's hurry. On March 7th, General Ironside, chief of the British General Staff, informed Marshal Mannerheim that an Allied expeditionary force of 57,000 men was ready to come to the aid of the Finns, and that the 1st Division of 15,000 troops could reach Finland by the end of March if Norway and Sweden would allow them transit. Actually, 5 days before, on March 2nd, as Mannerheim knew, both Norway and Sweden had again turned down the Franco-British request for transit privileges. This did not prevent Premier Daladier on March 8th from scolding the Finns for not officially asking for Allied troops, and from intimating that the Allied forces would be sent regardless of Norwegian and Swedish protests. But Mannerheim was not to be fooled, and having advised his government to sue for peace while the Finnish army was still intact and undefeated, he approved the immediate dispatch of a peace delegation to Moscow on March 8th. The Finnish commander-in-chief seems to have been skeptical of the French zeal for fighting on the Finnish front rather than on their own front in France. See the memoirs of Marshal Mannerheim. One can only speculate on the utter confusion which would have resulted among the belligerents had the Franco-British Expeditionary Corps ever arrived in Finland and fought the Russians. In little more than a year, Germany would be at war with Russia, in which case the enemies in the West would have been allies in the East. But on March 12th, the Russo-Finnish War suddenly ended, with Finland accepting Russia's harsh terms for peace. While this was generally welcomed in Berlin because it freed Germany from its unpopular championship of the Russians against the Finns, and also brought an end, for the moment, of the Soviet drive to take over the Baltic, it nevertheless embarrassed Hitler so far as his own Scandinavian venture was concerned. As Jodl confided to his diary, it made the motivation for the occupation of Norway and Denmark difficult. Conclusion of peace between Finland and Russia, he noted on March 12th, deprives England, but us too, of any political basis to occupy Norway. In fact, Hitler was now hard put to find an excuse. On March 13th, the faithful Jodl recorded that the Führer was still looking for some justification. The next day, Führer has not yet decided how to justify the Weser exercise. To make matters worse, Admiral Raeder began to get cold feet. He was in doubt whether it was still important to play at preventive war in Norway. For the moment, Hitler hesitated. Two other problems had, in the meantime, arisen. One, how to handle Sumner Wells, the United States Undersecretary of State, who had arrived in Berlin March 1st on a mission from President Roosevelt to see if there was any chance of ending the war before the slaughter began in the West. And two, how to placate the neglected, offended Italian ally. Hitler had not yet bothered to answer Mussolini's defiant letter of January 3rd, and relations between Berlin and Rome had distinctly cooled. Now Sumner Wells, the Germans believed, and with some reason, had come to Europe to try to detach Italy from the creaky axis, and persuade her at any event not to enter the war on Germany's side if the conflict continued. Various warnings had reached Berlin from Rome that it was time something were done to keep the sulking Duce in line. Hitler meets with Sumner Wells and Mussolini. Hitler's ignorance of the United States, as well as that of Goering and Ribbentrop, was abysmal. And though their policy at this time was to try to keep America out of the war, they, like their predecessors in Berlin in 1914, did not take the Yankee nation seriously as even a potential military power. Examples of Hitler's weird views on America have been given in earlier chapters, but in the captured Foreign Office documents there is a revealing paper on the Führer's state of mind at this very moment. On March 12th, Hitler had a long talk with Colin Ross, a German expert on the United States, who had recently returned from a lecture trip in America where he had contributed his mite to Nazi propaganda. When Ross remarked that an imperialist tendency prevailed in the United States, Hitler asked, according to the shorthand notes of Dr. Schmidt, whether this imperialist tendency did not strengthen the desire for the Anschluss of Canada to the United States and thus produce an anti-English attitude. It must be admitted that Hitler's advisers on the USA were not very helpful in shedding light on their subject. At the same interview, Ross, in trying to answer Hitler's question as to why America was so anti-German, gave the following answers, among others. An additional factor in hatred against Germany is the monstrous power of Jewry, directing with a really fantastic cleverness and organizational skill the struggle against everything German and National Socialist. Colin Ross then talked about Roosevelt, whom he believes to be an enemy of the Führer for reasons of pure personal jealousy, and also on account of his personal lust for power. He had come to power the same year as the Führer, and he had to watch the latter carrying out his great plans, while he, Roosevelt, had not reached his goal. He too had ideas of dictatorship which in some respects were very similar to National Socialist ideas. Yet precisely this realization that the Führer had attained his goal while he had not gave to his pathological ambition the desire to act upon the stage of world history as the Führer's rival. After Herr Kallenross had taken his leave, the Führer remarked that Ross was a very intelligent man, who certainly had many good ideas. As early as October 1, 1939, the German military attaché in Washington, General Friedrich von Bertiger, advised OKW in Berlin not to worry about any possible American expeditionary force in Europe. On December 1, he further informed his military superiors in Berlin that American armament was simply inadequate for an aggressive war policy, and added that the general staff in Washington, in contrast to the State Department's sterile policy of hatred and the impulsive policy of Roosevelt, often based on an overestimation of American military power, still has understanding for Germany and her conduct of the war. In his first dispatch, Bertiger had noted that Lindbergh and the famous flyer Rickenbacker were advocating keeping America out of the war. By December 1, however, despite his low estimate of American military power, he warned OKW that the United States will still enter the war if it considers that the Western Hemisphere is threatened. Hans Thompson, the German chargé d'affaires in Washington, did his best to impart some facts about the USA to his ignorant foreign minister in Berlin. On September 18, as the Polish campaign neared its end, he warned the Wilhelmstrasse that the sympathies of the overwhelming majority of the American people are with our enemies, and America is convinced of Germany's war guilt. In the same dispatch, he pointed out the dire consequences of any attempts by Germany to carry out sabotage in America, and requested that there be no such sabotage in any manner whatsoever. The request evidently was not taken very seriously in Berlin, for on January 25, 1940, Thompson was wiring Berlin, "I have learned that a German-American, von Hausberger, and a German citizen, Walter, both of New York, are alleged to be planning acts of sabotage against the American armament industry by direction of the German Abwehr. Von Hausberger is supposed to have detonators hidden in his dwelling." Thompson asked Berlin to desist, declaring that "there is no surer way of driving America into the war than by resorting again to a course of action which drove America into the ranks of our enemies once before in the World War, and incidentally did not in the least impede the war industries of the United States. Besides," he added, "both individuals are unfitted in every respect to act as agents of the Abwehr." Weizsäcker replied that Canaris himself had assured him that neither of the men mentioned by Thompson was an agent of the Abwehr. But no good Secret Service admits these things. Other Foreign Office papers reveal that on January 24th, an Abwehr agent left Buenos Aires with instructions to report to Fritz von Hausberger at Weehawken, New Jersey, for instructions in our specialty. Another agent had been sent from the same place to New York in December to gather information on American aircraft factories and arms shipments to the Allies. Thompson himself reported on February 20th the arrival of Baron Konstantin von Meidel, a Baltic German of Estonian citizenship, who had told the German embassy in Washington that he was on a sabotage mission for the Abwehr. Since November 1938, when Roosevelt had recalled the American ambassador in Berlin in protest against the officially sponsored Nazi pogrom against the Jews, neither country had been represented in the other by an ambassador. Trade had dwindled to a mere trickle, largely as the result of American boycotts, and was now completely shut down by the British blockade. On November 4, 1939, the arms embargo was lifted, following votes in the Senate and the House, thus opening the way for the United States to supply the Western Allies with arms. It was against this background of rapidly deteriorating relations that Sumner Welles arrived in Berlin on March 1, 1940. The day before, on February 29th, it was a leap year, Hitler had taken the unusual step of issuing a secret directive for the conversations with Mr. Sumner Welles. It called for reserve on the German side and advised that, as far as possible, Mr. Welles be allowed to do the talking. It then laid down 5 points for the guidance of all the top officials who were to receive the special American envoy. The principal German argument was to be that Germany had not declared war on Britain and France, but vice versa, that the Führer had offered them peace in October and that they had rejected it, that Germany accepted the challenge, that the war aims of Britain and France were the destruction of the German state, and that Germany therefore had no alternative but to continue the war. A discussion, Hitler concluded, of concrete political questions, such as the question of a future Polish state, is to be avoided as much as possible. In case he brings up subjects of this kind, the reply should be that such questions are decided by me. It is self-evident that it is entirely out of the question to discuss the subject of Austria and the protectorate of Bohemia and Moravia. All statements are to be avoided which could be interpreted to mean that Germany is in any way interested at present in discussing possibilities of peace. I request, rather, that Mr. Sumner Wells not be given the slightest reason to doubt that Germany is determined to end this war victoriously. Not only Ribbentrop and Goering, but the leader himself followed the directive to a letter when they saw Wells separately on March 1st, 3rd, and 2nd, respectively. Judging by the lengthy minutes of the talks kept by Dr. Schmidt, which are among the captured documents, the American diplomat, a somewhat taciturn and cynical man, must have got the impression that he had landed in a lunatic asylum, if he could believe his ears. Each of the big three Nazis bombarded Wells with the most grotesque perversions of history, in which facts were fantastically twisted and even the simplest of words lost all meaning. "Before God and the world," Goering exclaimed to Wells, "he, the field marshal, could state that Germany had not desired the war. It had been forced upon her. But what was Germany to do when the others wanted to destroy her?" Hitler, who on March 1st had issued his directive for Weserübung, received Wells the next day and insisted that the Allied war aim was annihilation, that of Germany, peace. He lectured his visitor on all he had done to maintain peace with England and France. Shortly before the outbreak of the war, the British ambassador had sat exactly where Sumner Wells was now sitting, and the Führer had made him the greatest offer of his life. All his offers to the British had been rejected, and now Britain was out to destroy Germany. Hitler therefore believed that the conflict would have to be fought to a finish. There was no other solution than a life-and-death struggle. No wonder that Wells confided to Weizsäcker and repeated to Goering that if Germany were determined to win a military victory in the West, then his trip to Europe was pointless, and there was nothing more for him to say. A quite unofficial American peacemaker was also in Berlin at this time, James D. Mooney, a vice president of General Motors. He had been in Berlin, as I recall, shortly before or after the outbreak of the war, trying like that other amateur in diplomacy, Dollerus, though without the latter's connections, to save the peace. The day after Wells left Berlin, on March 4, 1940, Hitler received Mooney, who told him, according to a captured German record of the meeting, that President Roosevelt was more friendly and sympathetic to Germany than was generally believed in Berlin, and that the president was prepared to act as moderator in bringing the belligerents together. Hitler merely repeated what he had told Wells 2 days before. On March 11th, Thompson sent to Berlin a confidential memorandum prepared for him by an unnamed American informant, declaring that Mooney was more or less pro-German. The General Motors executive was certainly taken in by the Germans. Thompson's memorandum states that Mooney had informed Roosevelt on the basis of an earlier talk with Hitler that the Führer was desirous of peace and wished to prevent the bloodshed of a spring campaign. Hans Dieckhoff, the recalled German ambassador to the United States, who was whiling away his time in Berlin, saw Mooney immediately after the latter's interview with Hitler and reported to the Foreign Office that the American businessman was rather verbose and that "I cannot believe that the Mooney initiative has any great importance." Though he had emphasized in his talks with the Germans that what he heard from the European statesmen on this trip was for the ears of Roosevelt only, Wells thought it wise to be sufficiently indiscreet to tell both Hitler and Goering that he had had a long, constructive, and helpful talk with Mussolini, and that the Duce thought there was still a possibility of bringing about a firm and lasting peace in Europe. If these were the Italian dictator's thoughts, then it was time, the Germans realized, to correct them. Peace, yes, but only after a resounding German victory in the West. Hitler's failure to answer Mussolini's letter of January 3rd had filled the Duce with mounting annoyance. All through the month, Ambassador Attolico was inquiring of Ribbentrop when a reply might be expected and hinting that Italy's relations with France and Britain, and their trade to boot, were improving. This trade, which included Italian sales of war materials, aggravated the Germans, who constantly protested in Rome that it was unduly aiding the Western Allies. Ambassador von Mackensen kept reporting his grave anxieties to his friend Weizsäcker, and the latter himself was afraid that Mussolini's unanswered letter, if it were disregarded much longer, would give the Duce freedom of action. He and Italy might be lost for good. Then on March 1st, Hitler received a break. The British announced that they were cutting off shipments of German coal by sea via Rotterdam to Italy. This was a heavy blow to the Italian economy and threw the Duce into a rage against the British and warmed his feelings toward the Germans, who promptly promised to find the means of delivering their coal by rail. Taking advantage of this circumstance, Hitler got off a long letter to Mussolini on March 8th, which Ribbentrop delivered personally in Rome 2 days later. It made no apologies for its belatedness, but was cordial in tone and went into considerable detail about the Führer's thoughts and policies on almost every conceivable subject, being more wordy than any previous letter of Hitler's to his Italian partner. It defended the Nazi alliance with Russia, the abandonment of the Finns, the failure to leave even a rump Poland. If I had withdrawn the German troops from the general government, this would not have brought about a pacification of Poland, but a hideous chaos, and the church would not have been able to exercise its function in praise of the Lord, but the priests would have had their heads chopped off. As for the visit of Sumner Wells, Hitler continued, it had achieved nothing. He was still determined to attack in the West. He realized that the coming battle will not be a walkover, but the fiercest struggle in Germany's history, a battle for life or death. And then Hitler made his pitch to Mussolini to get into the war. "I believe, Duce, that there can be no doubt that the outcome of this war will also decide the future of Italy. You will someday be confronted by the very opponents who are fighting Germany today. I, too, see the destinies of our two countries, our peoples, our revolutions, and our regimes indissolubly joined with each other. And finally, let me assure you that in spite of everything, I believe that sooner or later fate will force us, after all, to fight side by side. That is, that you will likewise not escape this clash of arms, no matter how the individual aspects of the situation may develop today, and that your place will then be more than ever at our side, just as mine will be at yours." Mussolini was flattered by the letter and at once assured Ribbentrop that he agreed that his place was at Hitler's side on the firing line. The Nazi foreign minister, on his part, lost no time in buttering up his host. The Führer, he said, was deeply aroused by the latest British measures to block the shipment of coal from Germany to Italy by sea. How much coal did the Italians need? "From 500,000 to 700,000 tons a month," Mussolini replied. Germany was now prepared, Ribbentrop answered glibly, to furnish 1 million tons a month and would provide most of the cars to haul it. There were two lengthy meetings between the two, with Ciano present, on March 11th and 12th. And Dr. Schmidt's shorthand minutes reveal that Ribbentrop was at his most flatulent. Though there were more important things to talk about, he produced captured Polish diplomatic dispatches from the Western capitals to show the monstrous war guilt of the United States. The foreign minister explained that these documents showed specifically the sinister role of the American ambassadors Bullitt, Paris, Kennedy, London, and Drexel Biddle, Warsaw. They gave an intimation of the machinations of that Jewish plutocratic clique whose influence, through Morgan and Rockefeller, reached all the way up to Roosevelt. For several hours, the arrogant Nazi foreign minister raved on, displaying his customary ignorance of world affairs, emphasizing the common destiny of the two fascist nations, and stressing that Hitler would soon attack in the West, beat the French army in the course of the summer, and drive the British from the continent before fall. Mussolini mostly listened, only occasionally interjecting a remark whose sarcasm apparently escaped the Nazi minister. When, for example, Ribbentrop pompously declared that Stalin had renounced the idea of world revolution, the Duce retorted, according to Schmidt's notes, "Do you really believe that?" When Ribbentrop explained that there was not a single German soldier who did not believe that victory would be won this year, Mussolini interjected, "That is an extremely interesting remark." That evening, Ciano noted in his diary, "After the interview, when we were left alone, Mussolini says that he does not believe in the German offensive, nor in a complete German success. The Italian dictator had promised to give his own views at the meeting the next day, and Ribbentrop was somewhat uneasy as to what they might be, wiring Hitler that he had been unable to obtain a hint as to the Duce's thoughts. He need not have worried. The next day Mussolini was a completely different man. He had quite suddenly, as Schmidt noted, turned completely pro-war. It was not a question, he told his visitor, of whether Italy would enter the war on Germany's side, but when. The question of timing was extremely delicate, for he ought not to intervene until all his preparations were complete, so as not to burden his partner. In any event, he had to state at this time with all distinctness that Italy was in no position financially to sustain a long war. He could not afford to spend 1 billion lire a day, as England and France were doing. This remark seems to have set Ribbentrop back for a moment, and he tried to pin the Duce down on a date for Italy's entry into the war, but the latter was wary of committing himself. The moment would come, he said, when a definition of Italy's relations with France and England, i.e. a break with these countries, would occur. It would be easy, he added, to provoke such a rupture. Though he persisted, Ribbentrop could not get a definite date. Obviously Hitler himself would have to intervene personally for that. The Nazi foreign minister thereupon suggested a meeting at the Brenner between the two men for the latter part of March, after the 19th, to which Mussolini readily agreed. Ribbentrop, incidentally, had not breathed a word about Hitler's plans to occupy Denmark and Norway. There were some secrets you did not mention to an ally, even while pressing for it to join you. Though he had not succeeded in getting Mussolini to agree to a date, Ribbentrop had lured the Duce into a commitment to enter the war. If he wanted to reinforce the Axis, Ciano lamented in his diary, he has succeeded. When Sumner Wells, after visiting Berlin, Paris, and London, returned to Rome and saw Mussolini again on March 16th, he found him a changed man. He seemed to have thrown off some great weight, Wells wrote later. I have often wondered whether, during the 2 weeks which had elapsed since my first visit to Rome, he had not determined to cross the Rubicon, and during Ribbentrop's visit had not decided to force Italy into the war. Wells need not have wondered. As soon as Ribbentrop had departed Rome in his special train, the anguished Italian dictator was prey to second thoughts. He fears, Ciano jotted in his diary on March 12th, that he has gone too far in his commitment to fight against the Allies. He would now like to dissuade Hitler from his land offensive, and this he hopes to achieve at the meeting at the Brenner Pass. But Ciano, limited as he was, knew better. It cannot be denied, he added in his diary, that the Duce is fascinated by Hitler, a fascination which involves something deeply rooted in his makeup. The Führer will get more out of the Duce than Ribbentrop was able to get. This was true, with reservations, and shortly will be seen. No sooner had he returned to Berlin than Ribbentrop telephoned Ciano on March 13th, asking that the Brenner meeting be set earlier than contemplated, for March 18th. The Germans are unbearable, Mussolini exploded. They don't give one time to breathe or to think matters over. Nevertheless, he agreed to the date. The Duce was nervous, Ciano recorded in his diary that day. Until now he has lived under the illusion that a real war would not be waged. The prospect of an imminent clash in which he might remain an outsider disturbs him, and to use his words, humiliates him. It was snowing when the respective trains of the two dictators drew in on the morning of March 18, 1940, at the little frontier station at the Brenner Pass below the lofty snow-mantled Alps. The meeting, as a sop to Mussolini, took place in the Duce's private railroad car, but Hitler did almost all the talking. Ciano summed up the conference in his diary that evening. The conference is more a monologue. Hitler talks all the time. Mussolini listens to him with interest and with deference. He speaks little and confirms his intention to move with Germany. He reserves to himself only the choice of the right moment. He realized, Mussolini said, when he was finally able to get in a word, that it was impossible to remain neutral until the end of the war. Cooperation with England and France was inconceivable. We hate them. Therefore, Italy's entry into the war is inevitable. Hitler had spent more than an hour trying to convince him of that, if Italy did not want to be left out in the cold and, as he added, become a second-rate power. But having answered the main question to the Führer's satisfaction, the Duce immediately began to hedge. The great problem, however, was the date. One condition for this would have to be fulfilled. Italy would have to be very well prepared. Italy's financial position did not allow her to wage a protracted war. He was asking the Führer whether there would be any danger for Germany if the offensive were delayed. He did not believe there was such a danger. He would then have finished his military preparations in 3 to 4 months.